Welcome to a Punstemology.
Just a moon doctor. You know what I like a lot more than materialistic things? Knowledge. What is this?
It's a podcast.
Good morning, good day, and good evening to everyone, regardless of what time you're tuning in. Thanks for joining me for another episode of A Podstemology. And if you're new to the show, welcome. My guest this week is Nathan Lane, Associate Professor of Economics at Oxford University and founder and fellow at the Sodar Labs of Monash University. Our topic is industrial policy. In what ways can governments, especially in developing countries, intervene in the economy to promote desired economic ends? Industrial policy has something of a checkered history. In the post-Great Depression and post-World War II years, it was widely regarded as an obviously good thing, even by neoclassical economists. Indeed, Paul Samuelson, perhaps the founder of neoclassical economics, fully expected the Soviet Union to eventually overtake the economy of the United States due to the superiority of its central planning approach. We then saw a big reversal in the 1970s amid stagflation, butter mountains, wine lakes, and the other blighted fruits of price controls, subsidies, and tariffs that defined industrial policy in that era. The Chicago School's neoliberal agenda saw industrial policy widely panned and policymakers let the market rip. In some cases, notably Australia and China, that worked quite well, in part because the state retreated from things the market was good at, but not from things that the state was good at. In other cases, neoliberalism was a bit more of a disaster. And so, nowadays, we see something of a revival in industrial policy, especially with climate change demanding major economic restructuring. But this industrial policy is less muscular and more market-friendly than that of the 20th century. Nathan is here to tell us all about these nuances and help us better understand the history and future of industrial policy. Please make him feel welcome.
A Podstemology.
Hi, Nathan. Welcome to A Podstemology. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. It's great. It's great to be here. It's great to be on.
So could you tell us a little bit about your research interests? What gets you motivated?
Yeah. So lately I'm kind of like really knee deep in industrial policy, how states, how governments try to affect the structure of the economy and whether they can do so. But in general, I'm kind of interested broadly in the political economy of development, how political institutions and states kind of shape the trajectory of growth and how countries and economies evolve. I think broadly that's the kind of stuff that makes me excited.
Mm-hmm. And are you mostly an economic historian? Is that how you describe yourself in as a subfield?
Yeah, it's a tough one. It's like, because I have a bit of identity crisis. I think there's a lot of people kind of in economic history who kind of feel that a bit of identity crisis there. Because a lot of us are probably also interested in growth or economic development writ large and the questions of economic development writ large, just at a longer run or even the medium run. So it's like, I think I'm a development economist. My heart is in economic history for sure. Mm-hmm. It can be a bit of an odd identity because economic history can be so very specific sometimes and kind of focus on very specific questions, especially in Europe, especially, you know, people are very interested in European economies and the European experience of industrialization very much kind of defines sometimes the parameters of what people think of as economic history. In terms of those parameters, I'm a little outside.
Because you mostly work on Asia or?
I'm really kind of interested in the global economy. And of course, there's plenty of economic historians who are, but you think of like if I go to an economic history seminar, what the major things that come up are like these grand kind of like, especially here where we are. Industrialization of the UK or Great Britain or Western Europe or US centric questions as well. So when you're doing developing countries, you're a bit outside of that.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, maybe we'll come back to some questions of economic history because I'm very interested in that. But maybe it's a bit too much like the a topic for economists, not for a general audience. So maybe
sure.
Why don't you tell us, please, then, what is industrial policy, particularly in the context of that you study it?
Yeah. It's a tough thing because people have different kind of definitions of it. And we think of broadly kind of intentional state action meant to kind of transform the structure of an economy,
mm-hmm.
the type of economic activity that is occurring within an economy. It's like very intentional state actions and policies meant to kind of shift what would otherwise happen in the economy, what would naturally arise mm-hmm. in the economy without that intervention. And so
okay.
it's very much like a state component to it, a political component to it, because it's some political arm or some apparatus of the state that's shaping this in an intentional way, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm. What are some examples of industrial policy?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on right now. Like, I think, you know, probably the most salient right now would be certain policies meant to like spur PPE production. Amid COVID and things like this, like how do we get factories producing PPE goods ASAP amid markets that aren't functioning, amid supply chains that aren't functioning? Or in the U.S., there's some very salient policies Biden is pursuing around semiconductors. How do we domestic? How do we create a domestic semiconductor industry in the U.S. or things like the Green New Deal? How do we Green New Deal can be an even bigger package, but part of that presumably is how do we incentivize green economic activity of some sort,
mm-hmm.
Shifts away from carbon heavy or environmentally
pernicious,
yeah, environmentally pernicious economic activity of the past. Mm-hmm. The coal, the type of stuff that are back in Australia.
Oh yeah, sure, yes, embarrassing for us.
I know.
So what are some of the specific mechanisms that industrial policy employs? So I'm thinking in terms of like price controls. So at the moment in Britain, there's a lot of talk about gas price spikes.
Because
we have no lorry drivers because of Brexit, and so the government has said there will be no price rises, so obviously there's a strong price control. Is that industrial policy? What else?
It can be part of, like, you think of industrial policies, like there's like indeed like a somewhat overwhelming basket of policy levers that
mm-hmm.
that a country or state or government can appeal to in order to kind of promote economic activity or incentivize certain types of economic activity or shift away from certain older forms of economic activity. And so price controls could presumably be one of those levers. I think, the classic one would be tariffs or some type of overt protectionism.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of a canonical form of industrial policy. But it can also be used for other ends, just like price controls. Price controls can be, of course, used for other ends. So it's a big basket of tools, and a lot of these tools can be used for a multitude of reasons, but they can often be used as for industrial policy aims to kind of incentivize certain economic activity. But it gets tricky because a lot of them can have other uses. You know, price controls can have all sorts of other kind of like pro-social concerns or price stability concerns of some sort that are beyond the purview of industrial policy. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it gets kind of complicated because a lot of things can get called just like the definition of industrial policy. Mm-hmm. The definition can be really squishy and can get really people sometimes talk about industrial policy without defining what they're talking about.
Sure.
And at the same time, people can be talking about various policy levers as though they are implicitly industrial policy, which mm-hmm. isn't always the case. You know, tariffs, for instance, they might be used to, say, classically incubate infant industry,
mm-hmm.
use of tariffs, but they can also be used for a multitude of other reasons. For instance, to just if you're a low fiscal capacity state, to
mm-hmm.
be used for purely fiscal reasons, et cetera. So you get into some issues there, and that kind of complicates the discussion of industrial policy because, well, the definition and the is squishy, and the toolbox is pretty big and pretty complex, and again can kind of be deployed for many reasons that aren't industrial policy.
Okay, great. So then I know that this is I used to do a bit of industrial policy research in my past life as a development economist. Yeah. And I remember that it was, I guess, fairly controversial within development studies. And I think it's, maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, but I'd say it's been through kind of some waves where it was, I mean, at the very least, kind of unpopular through the end of the 20th century, at least among, say, the World Bank and this kind of thing. And more recently, as I think, had a bit more of a revival. So I was wondering if you could maybe characterize for us a little bit the debates around industrial policy within development economics.
Yeah. So I think, at one point, and there were, one can say there were always probably, even before development economics was a, its own field or its own kind of, had a literature or was its own thing. There was industrial policy, infant industry type policies were always kind of controversial. There were always these kind of debates going on. You can go back to the kind of original
Frank like Adam Smith. All right, yeah.
Exactly. So this is a very kind of 19th century, of course, Adam Smith before that, right? You look at you go back to 19th century, there's very strong debates in the UK and Great Britain about the efficacy of industrial policy and whether this is a pro-liberal thing or a social welfare maximizing thing, or is this a politically backwards thing to do or economically backwards thing to do? And so it was always kind of had controversy, but within development economics, kind of when development really economics really came into being and kind of became solidified as like a body of knowledge, let's say in the post-war, it was kind of intimately tied to industrial policy and development studies were kind of very intertwined, and it wasn't that controversial at the time. I think maybe in the post-war, and again, there's surely people who rejected it outright. Even at the birth of kind of what we think of as development economics, but it was very much tied to that field. In the post-war, and then it was a robust part of the tool set of development economics, thinking about how do we promote industrialization or the reconstruction of economies in post-war Europe or post-war Asia Pacific and beyond. And for many reasons. And I should also say people were thinking about industrial policy and industrial development before then, of course, even in the interwar period. But it became part of the developmental kind of toolkit in the post-war period and was synonymous with development economics. But I think I'm giving a very cartoonish trajectory of it. I'd say It was used in some very cavalier ways, and in ways that weren't always successful, led to many problems in many different contexts, and had wide heterogeneity. And so, so you'd say the cracks started kind of forming in the 60s, really, and really, really taking hold in the 1970s, when the neoliberal kind of consensus was really coming to a head and really kind of starting to define the Washington institutions.
Yeah, and sure.
And before the 70s, industrial policy was relatively non-controversial part of the World Bank's tool set. They were very much bent and thinking about things like planning, you know, things that we would sound pretty alien today. The World Bank was thinking about planning and was thinking about industrial policy and thinking about optimal import substitution. These things were very much like part of the World Bank's, you know, policy menu at that time. But you know, the Washington Consensus, I think, had a very strong, convincing critique that became dominant, and eventually, maybe that's what you're hinting at. You know, became, to use an overly academic word, really, really hegemonic. But it became kind of the dominant way of thinking about development policy, development practice, and really rejected whole cloth the legacy and practice of industrial policy for maybe some pretty good reasons, because there were some pretty glaring episodes where it caused some definite problems. There was truly kind of episodes in Latin America, surely in Africa, but beyond, where industrial policy surely led to some failures, and that kind of that was happening at a time when people were very much questioning the statism of development policy writ large, and you know, the Chicago School and kind of the neoliberal consensus was arising just at a time when these glaring kind of outcomes of industrial policy's misuse were becoming just wholly salient. So by the 1980s, this industrial policy and a lot of like the kind of policy levers we talked about that were associated with industrial policy started becoming roundly rejected. And that rejection became codified in international, various international law and multilateral agreements. And its use was very much limited by the countries that were now joining what we think of as like the globalized world and globalization with, you know, with the Washington Consensus that had given birth to it, really limited the extent to which countries could pursue various levers of industrial policy. And I'd say, and I'm sorry, this is so long and meandering.
No, it's good. Yeah.
Is that, you know, I'd say like by the 1990, you know, people, you read a lot of quotes in you know, the international studies, which you're probably familiar with, where people are like, this really just doesn't work. The industrial globalization is one, and globalization and what we think of as the neoliberal consensus, or maybe more precisely Washington Consensus. You know, here's a policy menu that says, you know, these things didn't work. The state probably should have a minimal impact on trying to steer the trajectory of industrialization and growth beyond just a relatively, beyond a certain set of parameters. And so industrial policy was very much fell out of favor.
Cool. So before we get to the rebound, I guess, starting from maybe like 2005 or like with China's rise, I think we get an interesting rebound in the way we think about industrial policy. But maybe I'd just like to clarify the period that you just described. So you said that there was sort of clear evidence, or like surely it seemed that industrial policy had led to some bad outcomes. So I guess the examples are things like stagflation in America, hyperinflation in Latin America, just kind of wage price spirals in Africa, that sort of thing. And the policies that were implicated in that were particularly price controls, wage controls, foreign exchange controls, and tariffs and that sort of thing. Just sort of a bunch of, it seems to me like, one thing that always surprised me about the discussion around the Washington Consensus was that the countries in question that were then, you know, the recipients of structural adjustment lending and that sort of thing were cooked in a number of ways. So they had these big economic crises. Yes. And it's kind of reasonable to say that the roots of that crisis and a kind of reasonable agenda of reform would be to just get the government out of market interventions that really had no logic to them. They were mostly related to corruption or something like that, or just kind of poor thinking. But that the structural adjustment lending, in part because they were responding to a crisis, in part because they needed to get the money back to their donors, in part because there's corruption with these institutions, that sort of thing, kind of went beyond just getting the government out of these market interventions. It also had a lot of weird stuff, I think, like just general austerity. So like reducing spending on things that I think the Washington Consensus would actually endorse, like the government funding infrastructure or funding healthcare or education. Yeah. So is that is my analysis kind of broadly on target there?
Yeah. I think you're right. I think industrial policy, like things like capital controls or the parastatals, controlling certain commodity, production or commodity prices, and a lot of these like definitely can have, the Venn diagram can overlap with what is industrial policy. But you're right in that, tariffs, protectionism, the distortions that we think of as associated with these things were very much associated with industrial policy and protectionist interventions. And Kruger and people who had very powerful critiques from the Washington Consensus side of industrial policy would say, and you hinted at this as well, which I think is right, it's like the rent seeking, the kind of original OG kind of discussions around rent seeking. Really, you read the rent seeking papers, they're really talking often about industrial policy. These policies are supposed to be meant for industrial development. But it's clearly, you see policymakers and administrators and technocrats not doing technocratic things, but allocating policies in completely coherent ways that are politically self-serving or serve some political purpose, not some kind of technocratic pro-growth, pro-industrialization agenda, but that are very much rent-seeking in their objective. And so that was very much part of the Washington Consensus. And it definitely does dovetail, if I get the point right, with like the crises that happened through the 1980s that really retrenched a lot of industrial policies, structural adjustment lending, structural adjustment policies were I think giant understudied packages that had a lot in them that I feel like we haven't fully unpacked. Like at least I say we as in like mainstream economists.
Yeah.
They did a lot of stuff. And a lot of that was to kind of retrench industrial policy. But I agree too that like they did a lot more than that as well. And I definitely agree. But I think structural adjustment and was doing something like really interesting that haven't fully understood it. I feel like we haven't fully understood its impacts in a way that I feel are rigorous and kind of stand up to kind of empirical scrutiny, using today's kind of empirical techniques. I think, there's a lot of work to do there that's interesting because of the kind of policy levers and kind of conditions that you mentioned, I think are really interesting.
So could you describe them a bit, please? Like, what do you mean by the Washington Consensus? What is structural adjustment lending? And what was some of the kind of, what was the fallout from that? Because I suppose broadly the consensus seems to be that even if the Washington Consensus had a lot of smart, like sensible policy in it, the structural adjustment lending was mostly a disaster. Well, like it didn't have the outcomes that they intended it to have. What's structural kind of your take?
Yeah. So I think of like structural adjustment as kind of like something that was going on lateral to, maybe even downstream from what we think of as the Washington Consensus, which is, I should back up because temporarily, Washington Consensus can be associated with like, the Washington kind of think tank, establishment, you know, the intellectual community of like think tank, Washington DC think tanks, mm-hmm. kind of getting together and coming up with what they think of as like coming up with a menu of like what is best practice.
Yeah.
What is best practice? Of course, through the lens of neoclassical economics, mm-hmm. I think one can say in a rigorous way, in an intellectually defensible way, mm-hmm. neoliberalism.
Yeah.
You know, what is relatively defensible? And so people often cite John Williamson's Washington mm-hmm. think tanker came up with this 10-point list of that is usually very much associated with, and I think is a good representation of, mm-hmm. at least from my vantage point, of the Washington consensus. Like things like we need fiscal discipline, we need competitive exchange rates, we need trade liberalization, thus mm-hmm. kind of the relaxation of, we need to kind of get rid of the policy levers that are usually associated with industrial policy. We need to get rid of these things, and we need broadly liberalization, privatization, deregulation, and kind of a focus on property rights. You know, mm-hmm. the list is essentially some, you know, a 10-point list is essentially that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this kind of gets solidified around the same time that the structural adjustment policies are also coming into being, mm-hmm. and also being pursued by multilateral institutions as a response to some of the crises that are happening, mm-hmm. perhaps I think first in Ghana in the early 80s and also across Latin America, where people are trying to think about, okay, what is best practice? What is the best development practice? And I think, you know, I myself am not politically on the same page, but I think that people probably did have, mm-hmm. we're trying to be maybe sincere technocrats and sincerely yeah. believe this, surely. And you know, what is, you know, given what's happening in this kind of intellectually in this emergent thing that we think of as the Washington consensus, I think of a structural adjustment as kind of codifying that mm-hmm. as a response to the crises that are happening across the developing world. How do we get these countries, say the Ghanas of the world, out mm-hmm. of the situation they currently find themselves in? Yeah. And structural adjustment really started codifying these rules. And, mm-hmm. and because the Washington consensus is very much multidimensional, the structural adjustment loans, the conditions being put on these kind of bailout loans to mm-hmm. these foreign economies, are quite varied and uh-huh. have an amalgam of responses that we don't quite understand. That I think mm-hmm. are, that were at one time by economists accepted as largely successful. But right. I think that is up to controversy, and that's something that you hinted at. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually not, I think like the average effect of structural adjustment, I wouldn't even feel comfortable like characterizing it, because I think it's so complex, because mm-hmm. like, what is the effect of these like very multidimensional things that you're imposing on a country? It's like mm-hmm. very amid crisis.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm probably not like many mainstream development economists, where I'm like very skeptical of generalizations of structural adjustment as being broadly positive. Okay. Which probably diverges from the mainstream of probably the world you're coming from, which is development studies, which is rightly, I think, with good reason, very critical of structural adjustment policies that existed and that were implemented even until fairly recently.
I suppose I'm fairly sympathetic to the struggle that the lenders had in that situation. And I'm also yeah. sympathetic to how ignorant we were about development policy and corruption and the kind of institutional explanation for a lot of the issues that they were facing. So I don't rage at the institutions. I think I was more referring to, I remember reading an article by probably Danny Roderick, just arguing that all the countries that receive structural adjustment lending pretty much today are still kind of in the doldrums and don't seem to have really organized themselves. I think an interesting maybe exception to that is Indonesia and generally some of the Southeast Asian countries. So they obviously had these big IMF bailouts in the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s. That's often seen as kind of structural adjustment lending 2.0. Sure. And I know that Indonesia in particular was really scarred by that experience. And as a result, the Southeast Asian nations set up the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization, which is like a currency swap facility, so that in the future they wouldn't have to call on the IMF again because they were so pissed about it. And I mean, a kind of hot take on that is that, well, that's kind of exactly what the IMF wants. Like, oh, you're going to take fiscal responsibility. Cool. If that experience of a sort of fairly painful restructuring leads to institutional reforms that mean that the IMF doesn't have to step in again, maybe from a very long run perspective, that's exactly a good outcome. That's what you want.
I don't
know what your take on that is, your reaction.
No. I think that's an interesting analysis, and I think I'm fairly sympathetic to. I think where my hesitance with the effects of the Washington consensus are, it's like I see. How do I say this? It's like I see all these empirical studies that give you such varying answers to this. In fact, there's a famous paper that refers to it as an empirical glasnost. The effects of liberalization writ large, of which we think of these policies as kind of funneling liberalization through, conditional on receiving these structural adjustment loans and this lending. It's they're doing so much that its economic consequences for me are so hard to read. Because they're just so varied, so heterogeneous. And I feel like we haven't thought about these things rigorously enough insofar as their average effects, that I'm always so, I'm more referring to kind of people in my camp who and the way I took it, the development where these things were largely seen as, oh yeah, it's kind of pretty much worked. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what that means. And I think institutionally, like the dynamics you talk about are like, yeah, no, that seems like a pretty reasonable analysis of what happened institutionally. And so I guess I'm and also what I'm referring to too is I don't know what to call it. I think there's been this revival of new neoliberalism. Have you encountered this?
I don't think so. Do you mean like the kind of pro house building people, like that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Because I would class myself as neoliberal of that variety.
In that sense, but like I think broadly there's this kind of people, you know, being I am pro neoliberal and painting this whole experience as broadly successful and kind of erasing the nuance of it and reading, I think, what they want to out of this experience. I think a lot of this happening is actually broadly cultural. Very much an online artifact. And also is very much based in from kind of US think tankers and people from people who were not subjected to codified neoliberalism and, you know, a very kind of odd alternative history of what I think of as what neoliberalism was and very little engagement with structural adjustment lending for better or worse. I think some people are sincerely engaged with it, people like William Easterly's, I think insightful kind of, revisions that are optimistic about what structural adjustment did successfully from like a sincere, I think, political or empirical perspective. It's like, well, let's revisit this with the best tools we have. Well, it looked like it was on average maybe successful in some crucial ways, or some other papers that say that as well. But I myself think the story is much more subtle and we haven't arrived at a conclusion. So I guess my stance is very much of like, oh, there's this kind of new intellectual, kind of popular intellectual wave that is kind of recasting neoliberalism as a broad stroke success, where I'm like, whoa, wait. We were just kind of like getting to a point where we were kind of like interrogating this in, I think, a nice empirical way. What is this consensus assembly that we are so fond of? And so, yeah, okay. I don't know if that explains the
yeah, yeah, it does. That's interesting. Yeah, and yeah. So where do you think the academic discourse around industrial policy has gone since then, like I guess in the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, so kind of like picking up. So like Washington consensus, I guess I'll lay out like kind of like in broad strokes, kind of what happened to industrial policy after this? Well, I think we stopped measuring it. We stopped kind of studying it as an artifact, like as an empirical object of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And countries still kept using it. They kept calling it different things. And kind of its implementation was very much limited under things like the Washington consensus we talked about or structural adjustment policies, but countries kept using it.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of accepted, I think, in academia that, okay, this is a non-issue. This doesn't exist anymore. This, we know industrial policy doesn't work. Let's move on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the world kept, you know, that's a kind of academic dialogue, but the world kept using it and maybe calling it different things and using it in ways such that it comported with the international legal system that kind of embodied globalization.
Mm-hmm.
It still accommodates industrial policy in some ways, in some subtle ways, and countries still surely deploy it. Like countries like China surely deploy it. And so right as it was rejected, and you hinted to this as well, there are countries surely starkly using industrial policy and also having success.
Yeah.
Huge example being China, Vietnam might be another one.
Yeah.
Who were surely using these policy levers in creative ways, in ways that were very much inspired by what had happened in East Asia in the post-war. Mm-hmm. Another set of the what we think of as newly industrializing economies.
Yep, the tigers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who used industrial policy rather successfully with heterogeneity to industrialize very rapidly. And China surely adopted that template. And Vietnam surely did as well, along with kind of a pragmatic mixture of other policies that were surely also pretty liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that kind of like challenged, I think gradually kind of challenged, well, is industrial policy really this thing that is necessarily a failure? And then we have things like the financial crisis, and we have things that kind of start whittling away at the various pillars of the Washington consensus, which we thought was a broadly this thing that was empirically defensible. And so, you know, as the empirical revolution in economics occurs, as empirical revolution spreads to development economics, suddenly I think that open, and as kind of crisis happens, the global financial crisis and other things happen, I think it gave the latitude and kind of gave the space, again, along with China and the trade wars that came associated with China, it kind of gave the space for people to kind of once again start thinking, well, let's analyze this. Might industrial policy actually be more subtle? Might it have some pro-developmental effects rather than being this thing that's necessarily pernicious, that's necessarily deleterious, that's necessarily like anti-development? And so, like you hinted at, around the early 2000s, people who were challenging the Washington consensus writ large also started thinking, questioning the consensus around industrial policy. Okay. And other things like things that you hinted to before, like things like capital controls.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly people started cracking open the data and thinking, well, maybe the experiences around industrial policy are more varied and subtle than this Washington consensus had previously converged upon.
Sure.
Maybe the effects are much more subtle. Maybe this is something that we can study and accept and kind of take more seriously as not something that is necessarily due to fail, but actually something that might have some pro-development consequences if deployed properly. And
okay.
people like Joseph Stiglitz, those you mentioned, Danny Roderick, and those within, I guess, the heterodoxy of economics, Hajun Cheng, who was always quite bullish on industrial policy, this kind of discourse kind of came to a head in the early 2000s. And so this question of industrial policy as distinct necessary failure started kind of flipping. And I think what happened, you know, post financial crisis that really ramped up, and then Trump, economic nationalism, all these things came to a head. The Chinese trade war came to a head, and that really amplified the discourse around industrial policy. Oh, this country's surely doing this. We're having a trade war over it now in the U.S.
Yeah.
And, like, we need to take this probably pretty seriously. And that kind of like really amplified it. And that they came back to a head where I think eventually economics as a discipline couldn't just reject it as this thing that just doesn't happen.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so have economists developed any sort of paradigm for thinking about in this new age how to differentiate between kind of bad or dumb industrial policy and industrial policy that might have more of a pro-development effect?
We're trying. I think a couple of people, like, it's only very recently that we've been trying to, like, I think sincerely think about taking the tools of, and we're talking on a to date the podcast. Sorry if I'm dating the podcast. You can edit this out.
Yeah.
Sorry to date the podcast. You know, today the people who won the Nobel Prize were people who kind of led the empirical revolution in economics.
Mm-hmm.
Economics became very data driven.
Yeah.
Started
Who won the prize? I have not been up on the news.
Yeah. David Card.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Guido Embens and Josh Angris.
So okay. Yeah. All right. So very much the empirical turn masterminds. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry to interrupt you. Keep going.
No.
I'm surprised they didn't give one to Kruger posthumously if they gave it to the other three.
Pretty
yeah.
fair. I thought that
yeah.
pretty,
but anyway, let's not get bogged down in Nobel Prize discussions. Yeah.
No, but like, you know, so it's like that happened. And so I think only recently have people been kind of porting, like myself and other people, been kind of port those tools over to thinking about, well, what's dumb industrial policy, what's not dumb industrial policy? Because I think, sadly, the discourse or the converse, I should stop saying discourse, the conversation on industrial policy, I think, doesn't really differentiate those two things too well.
All right. Okay.
Both from the perspective of people who are very much vehemently opposed to industrial policy, no matter what, and people who are, I think, yeah, I'm very much sympathetic to industrial policy and its potential. But I think there's a lot of people who are very cavalier about it necessarily always working, and that's where I think, well, that you should probably be cautious there. And to that end, I don't think we have. I don't think we're necessarily at a point where we have the tools to really differentiate between the two or have like an agreed upon tool set that allows us to distinguish like between dumb industrial policy and not dumb industrial policy beyond maybe the obvious, like what Trump had done like in response to China. Let's protect a bunch of stuff in the kind of most knuckleheaded way possible.
Yeah.
Let's try to revive dying industries that will probably never come back. You know, that like prima facie is like probably dumb and dumb.
Yeah.
like just first glance, oh, this is like a non-starter. And so maybe we do have a way to differentiate dumb.
Yeah, whenever I read Lighthizer's comments on trade policy, I'm always like, do you have any idea what you're talking about? Like, how can you be this confounded if you've been working on this for 30 years? Like, you've got
baffling.
It fully backwards. Yeah.
Baffling. Like, people saying just crazy stuff about which was like a really strange place to be. Post 2016.
Very strange.
A very much a throwback. So I think to your point, like that would be pretty dumb industrial policy. And countries are doing it. And so that's to say I don't think we have I don't think we have like a toolbox that allows us to kind of we have a toolbox in economics that's like is essentially like, oh, any intervention is always going to be the conclusion of any intervention is like probably always pretty bad. And so through the lens of those tools, some of which are not quite empirical, that you know, their conclusion might be, well, a lot of things are dumb industrial policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, Trump's policy would fall under that set, you know, mm-hmm. with these analyses.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think the problem is a lot of these tools don't accommodate for industrial policy to actually have positive effects. And that's an issue.
Sure. So let me run my understanding of what I guess the World Bank, as I understand it, sort of advocates for nowadays, just because I'd be interested in your take on it from this nuanced empirical point of view. So I know that Justin Lin and some of his co-authors have been pushing this idea that economic development is broadly around following your comparative advantages as it organically shifts. So in a very low stage of development, your comparative advantage is low-skilled but voluminous labor. So you want to specialize in garments and this kind of stuff. Yeah. And then as you reinvest the proceeds from that in education, health, and infrastructure, you'll be able to move up to, you'll just naturally, your wages will rise as a result of being more skilled. And so your comparative advantage shifts, and then you move into like light electronics or something like that. And this mm-hmm. process mm-hmm. kind of repeats itself. And that process of comparative advantage, you don't want to like get really in there with a crowbar the way kind of old industrial policy worked. Like maybe yes. you don't want to put tariffs on the next sectors that you're going to move into. You want to let the market tell you what your emerging comparative advantages are. But once you have got that initial market signal, then there is a role for the government at the very least to correct information asymmetries and to kind of turbocharge that transition. So I think the example that I think is quite neat on this is the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. My understanding is what happened there was that after the Soviet Union kind of broke down, there was a kind of residual heavy industry in Macedonia. And so you had like the skills around the engineering there and that sort of thing. And you had some railway connections and power plants, like rudimentary stuff. And so some German car manufacturers set up plants there. And then the government went to speak to the car manufacturers. So there was just a few little investments there. And that's your kind of initial market signal that you might have an emerging comparative advantage. And then the government goes and says, I don't know exactly the specifics, but like, so why did you guys invest here? And now you've got to be very careful about corruption and all that sort of stuff. But assuming everything's clean and tidy, the investors might say, well, like you've got the relevant skills, blah, blah, blah. And then the government would say, okay, so like what, if we want to get more investment from you guys in similar industries and stuff, what do we need to do? And they might say, well, we really need a railway line here, or we really need power plants there, or something like that. And it's less about sort of tax concessions and that sort of thing, and more about addressing bottlenecks to scaling up whatever that investment is. So does that all sound kind of reasonable to you? Is there like something missing from that story? What are the
I think like I'm sympathetic to Lin's, like Dr. Lin's kind of mm-hmm. conception of industrial policy. That is that I think broadly the idea of using comparative advantage and kind of being mindful of the market signals in a highly integrated world.
Yeah.
Something one could leverage for the deployment of industrial policy. And I think in the past, the instances where you see, at least from my vantage point as someone kind of knee deep in the data in Asia, it's like, I think they were very mindful of this, to playing to one's comparative advantage that might not be realized yet, but where they have the potential to move into these markets, which are within reach, which he calls perhaps latent comparative advantage, that comparative advantage, which is not yet realized, but perhaps with investment, perhaps with FDI, foreign direct investment, and perhaps with other resources, there's the potential, which while risky, there's the potential to cultivate comparative advantage in these certain sectors. The point being that we do not want to, I think, like crowbar, like you said, our way into industries, sectors, product groups that are so beyond
So I worked I worked briefly an Indian MP like in New Delhi. I was doing a lot of notes for him on industrial policy and stuff. And that was right at the launch of the Make in India campaign. And I remember reading just the absolute worst consultants report I've ever come across from the Boston Consulting Group, where they were sort of outlining what sort of industrial policy the Indian government should get engaged in. And the comparator nations for India to learn lessons from whatever was always Japan and Germany. And I'm like, this is just not who you want to be comparing yourself to. I'm like, anyway.
Yeah, no. It's like, and I think that's the state of where a lot of research is, where it's like very too broad, like just super, super broad. I think comparative work is like truly extremely important, but it's like very high level. It's not enough to guide you or to guide us or to arm a policymaker with a tool set to make technocratic decisions at a granular level. I think that's where we're missing things. And therein, like, I think because of the fuzziness of our tool set and kind of some of the loose thinking around industrial policy, it means that some economies pursue industrial policy, I think in the words of Justin Lin, like that contradicts competitive advantage.
Right.
Well, South Korea did this. We can do this. Whoa, South Korea when? Like South Korea after like two decades of industrial policy, or is South Korea like post like a decade of heavy industrial investment? Like, so I think that's where I think his arguments are some of the more, I think, reasonable around industrial policy when taken from this entry point, that like we need to be mindful of our competitive advantage, and we need to be mindful of the price signals that tell us potentially where to aim. And like, I think it's not just the state that's mindful of this as well. It's like also those produced working in Vietnam, we see that like foreign direct invested firms are very interested in industrial policy because they love to produce more. They love more input suppliers from that domestic economy. So there's also like some private like signal coming from FDI insofar as what might be industries that Vietnam could potentially move into that could support foreign invested sectors in ways that are kind of mindful of comparative advantage. They're not going to jump into super, super, super high tech manufacturing for which they don't have the skilled labor force to pursue, or industries which like they're so far from the international frontier. And of course, there's people who argue that no, we shouldn't care about that. I think, and of course, I'm caricaturing their arguments, but there's people who say no, we actually shouldn't be mindful of these things, that and for relatively subtle reasons, comparative advantage is something we should ignore, and you know, so
okay,
we shouldn't be so fixated on that. To characterize comparative advantage is something we shouldn't be so fixated on.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So one thing you raised earlier was how industrial policy is different perhaps in a highly integrated world versus prior to a highly integrated world. And I just wanted to get your insights on this. So it does seem to me like one thing that's often missing from the commentary around industrial policy that reaches the public, like through The Guardian or these kind of popular books or something like that, is that the Korean story that you mentioned played out substantially. So I do guess just for everyone at home, like the South Korea is probably the most famous success study of industrial policy, along with, I guess, Taiwan and there's a few others. And that success story played out substantially before the World Trade Organization came into being, and also before the ICT revolution, so the information and coordination technologies revolution, which was a big part of like offshoring and all this kind of stuff. So I just wondered, like, what role does that globalization play in the transformation of industrial policy and what is effective or ineffective in industrial policy?
Yeah, I think it definitely complicates the story of industrial policy,
mm-hmm.
and it should kind of condition the way we think about industrial policy moving forward and what we learn about the past. I think, so South Korea, I think two things to say there is that, well, a couple of things to say is that,
mm-hmm.
well, because of the patterns of the Washington census and the international kind of, the legal frameworks that govern international economic activity do constrain the types of policies that governments can pursue. Not wholly, and that's something that does limit the toolbox that countries can deploy to pursue certain industrial development goals, especially very kind of targeted granular goals, the types of which were pursued by South Korea, let's say in the 60s and 70s. That said, GATT still existed, and GATT did allow them. GATT was mm-hmm. a little more permissive for countries to kind of pursue these types of things. The WTO, they still pursued industrial policy even when they ascended to the WTO. And so, mm-hmm. and you know, surely there's a lot of I don't want to say like, not hiding industrial policy. I'm kind of squirming because
Like non-distortionary subsidies, like this kind of
like China is accused of doing all sorts of backdoor industrial policy as a member of WTO. And countries are all of the times accused of pursuing industrial policy, even as members of the WTO, through kind of channels that aren't entirely salient,
mm-hmm.
Because the WTO limits the extent to which you are able to deploy certain tools for industrial development goals.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, like South Korea was pursuing, even I have a paper on this, hopefully out at the end of the year, where even in their supposedly liberal period, mm-hmm. They are pursuing industrial policy that mm-hmm. looks very pretty interventionist, mm-hmm. especially by today's standards, in the 80s and 90s. And so, they are still doing this stuff.
Yeah, and their green industrial policy is quite muscular, as I understand it.
That's also a great example. And so, mm-hmm. So if we think of the internet, globalization as the institutions of globalization that a lot of people argue don't permit industrial policy, well, that's true, but there's important caveats where all around the world, industrial policy is still pursued, even within those frameworks because of certain exceptions, or they're able to still deploy them maybe in some kind of clandestine ways.
Sure.
But you're right in that the global value chains, it does complicate industrial policy. And some people act as if that's probably a killer for industrial policy. And I'm sympathetic to that, but I'm also sympathetic to the fact that it might not be as well, because it means that hyper-specialization might also open the possibilities that you can become highly specialized in certain slivers of the global supply chain, in which industrial policy might be deployed, along with, and what we see now is industrial policy is deployed alongside policies thought of to be relatively liberal, FDI, with the help of kind of companies who are trying to offshore stuff, who want a solid industrial base to pursue offshore economic activity with,
mm-hmm.
And are relatively open to industrial policy for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I would have said that industrial policy is almost easier nowadays. Like in the past, it seemed to me the main thing was that you couldn't liberalize in a lot of ways because other countries still had their borders shut, full of tariffs and everything. And so you would just end up in a foreign exchange crisis, basically. So you needed to do a kind of strategic liberalization where you have some import controls and you're kind of exporting some things to get your Forex and whatever. And so the pre-WTO period for South Korea, for example, was a very complex balancing act of all these different Yeah, whereas nowadays it's just kind of like, oh yeah, we're all liberalized. No one's got their barriers down. Forex is a lot more of a chill issue. We don't have balance of payments crises every week. And so now I can just kind of, yeah, look for my comparative advantage and just kind of grease the wheels a bit and worry a lot more about coordination. So like in Malaysia, there seems to be an incredible architecture around coordinating all these complementary industries that you mentioned before. I would have thought that it's kind of in some ways the golden age of industrial policy. It's just more light touch than it used to be.
Yeah, no, I think there is there is some more specificity to it. And that's, I think, where industrial policy has to probably take a different form than it took in the past. And that, well, it has to be feasible under these international legal frameworks that many countries are obliged to follow. But at the same time, it has to kind of obey such a fractured global supply chain. But that fractured global supply chain in and of itself doesn't preclude industrial policy. And some critics of industrial policy speak as if it necessarily does. And that's where I'm like, well, I'm not sure about that. Because because one firm might constitute the lion's share of very specific slices of the specific global supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes in that 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 gives you a pretty large target with which to kind of aim industrial policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I agree that there is an ambiguity to it. It doesn't necessarily rule out industrial policy. I actually think it makes it more incentive compatible in some ways, because you have to be compatible with an external market often, because so many countries that pursue it, you're necessarily going to have to export this stuff. And the international market is a crushingly competitive market that you have to work with, and if you're plugged into the global supply chain, you probably have a downstream purchaser of your goods who have qualities who are going to hold you to that. And so I think it means that industrial policy might be more likely to deployed if when it is deployed, it might be held to standards that are quite rational.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think that's actually might be a really nice point for us to finish on, because I think we've been talking for about an hour and that nicely pulls everything together. So, well, thanks very much, Nathan. This has been a really stimulating conversation.
Awesome.
Apodstomology. If you enjoyed today's discussion, do check out Apodstomology's page at your favorite podcast directory for more episodes on topics as diverse as tax policy and the meaning of life.